So, not quite done with Sati yet. And I'm sure that many of you are aware of the way that mindfulness has been incorporated into a pretty wide spectrum of therapeutic applications in our culture, whether it's addressing, you know, chronic physical pain or depression relapse or psychosis or education. There has been created a whole wealth and a whole array of mindfulness-based applications. But I know when I work with these groups of people, professionals, who are using these primarily in the field of mental and physical health, there still remains this kind of question or a sense of bewilderment, because they're seeing this kind of startling, sometimes quite startling outcomes of people beginning to be mindful in their lives and the radical changes it can make. And yet still there's often, people often come to me with this sense of bewilderment of like, we don't really know what's going on here. You know, we don't really know why this is working or why it is bringing about such major transformations in people's lives who've never heard, obviously, mostly about Buddhism. Now, the reason why, of course, mindfulness can have a profound effect upon people is not just because they're learning to eyeball something more closely, but because woven into many of these mindfulness-based applications, there are actually woven into it the seven factors of enlightenment. In Buddhist teaching, these tend to be much more explicit. In many mindfulness-based applications, it's much more a kind of subtext. But clearly what allows people to make very radical changes in their way of seeing, their way of thinking, their way of relating, has something to do with the cognitive shifts, what we would call insights. The cognitive shifts that are enabled by mindfulness. So I just want to give you a little bit of a run through on what those shifts are and why mindfulness or why sati is effective. What is the job of sati? Well, the first job of sati is to slow down the process. To slow down the process of heart and mind. And I'm sure many of you have experienced this on retreat, in beginning with a mind that just feels to be a jumble of thoughts, you know, one ricocheting, following after another. That as you really begin to pay attention, that process begins to slow down. And you begin to see what is actually going on in your mind and body. The first job of mindfulness is to slow the process down. The second job of sati is to illuminate the moment. It's to shine the light of attention upon the moment. Now, again, you, I'm sure, have some very first-hand experience of this, that if you go outside to do a walking meditation and you're just lost in some preoccupation or some grand fantasy or some grand plan, that, you know, hearing the bell go, if you hear it at all, but hearing the bell go, you could come back inside and realize that you have not seen really a single thing on your walking path, and that you have not actually been attentive or inclusive of anything outside of that jumble of preoccupation. And yet if you go out into exactly the same walking path with a more intentional mindfulness, you can really see how mindfulness or sati illuminates the moment. You begin to see the flowers, the textures of the cobbles, of the paving stones. You know, you hear the sounds of the birds. You feel the touch of the air on your skin. And you can see that intentional mindfulness is, in a way, waking up the world. Now, and of course, exactly the same principle applies when that same intentional mindfulness is brought to shine upon the processes of our own mind and body. What previously was obscured by preoccupation or by the hindrances, suddenly it is illuminated. It becomes more clear. It's almost as if mindfulness is waking up that inner world. Now, the third job of mindfulness is to shift from impulse to intentional attention. And you really see this, that when you are not mindful, how impulse kind of reigns, doesn't it? Impulse occupies the throne, you know? I'm pushed towards this, I move away from that, you know, I'm going for this, you know, I'm caught here, you know, I'm acting on this kind of impulsive level of reactivity, really. So what mindfulness doing is that it's training in intentionality. It's an embodied intentionality. We keep coming back, you know, we keep returning. We keep gathering our, collecting our attention out of that jumble to have an intentional way of being present in the moment. Now that training from impulse to intention, there is, you can sense it, there is a restraining element within the sati, isn't it? You know, so you can see like maybe a memory arises and you can feel that first surge of, you know, I'm just going to get really involved in this. And then there's that little voice that says, you know, oh, maybe not. You know, maybe not. Maybe I don't actually need to feed this in exactly the same way. So you can feel the restraining element in the sati. Now, the fourth job of mindfulness is actually an attitudinal shift. Now, you can see it is a very human response or reaction to be afraid of the unpleasant, to be afraid of the painful. And the way that that usually manifests in our lives, of course, is in aversion. You know, pushing away, you know, closing down to, shutting out, fearing, resisting. So mindfulness is actually very much concerned with an attitudinal shift. It's not attitudinally neutral sati. It's concerned with an attitudinal shift from aversion to befriending, from aversion to welcoming, from resisting to including. The subtext of this is a training in kindness. You know, this is a training in metta, rather than aversion. Mindfulness has these qualities of warmth, of kindness, and it's a learning of a new and often radically different way of relating to all experience, but particularly to unpleasant experience. Moving from that pushing away to being with. The last of the jobs of mind, that allows actually a shift from reactivity to responsiveness. You know, because aversion is really concerned with reactivity. Impulse is really concerned with reactivity. So intention and befriending is a movement towards responsiveness. Now, the last of the kind of trainings built into sati is a training in non-identification. Now, you see this in the Satipatthana Sutta, to contemplate the body as the body, to contemplate feeling as feeling, to contemplate thought as thought. It is a training in non-identification. I mean, you see it, you know, in the Satipatthana Sutta, it is not introducing something we haven't already been doing all of our lives, contemplating our bodies and contemplating feelings and contemplating emotions and mental states. But without sati, we are usually contemplating through the lens of self. Right? My body, my feelings, my emotions, you know, my mental states. So the Satipatthana Sutta is just really inviting a kind of shift sideways to begin to contemplate through a different lens, the lens of non-self or not-self, the body as the body, feeling as feeling, mental state as mental states, or emotions as emotions. So the subtext, you know, is to see things as they actually are, to see a thought, a sensation as a sensation. All of this, the subtext, the cognitive subtext, is that it is a training in non-identification. So part of wise mindfulness, clearly, is to clear the cognitive field. Because we do see the way that there is a tendency to be constantly embroidering upon sense impressions. Isn't it? We hear the sound outside of the window, you know, we know it's a car alarm, and before we know it, we're into this whole kind of surge of, you know, the mindless world that forgets to turn off its car alarms and its cell phones and is always intruding on me. So we're constantly embroidering upon sense impressions, you know, beautiful, not beautiful, you know, lovely, not lovely. So it's learning to kind of simplify, you know, to actually come to a sound, a sight as a sight, to see that it's possible to let go of all of the embroidery, to simplify within our hearts. So it is kind of, you know, part of my first, when I talked about attention or wise attention being part of the fabric of mindfulness, that the Buddha often defines wise attention as not grasping at the sense impressions or the associations with it. It's not excluding the sense impressions, but not grasping at the sense impressions or the associations with them. So there is nothing passive, or, you know, you can see how sati in itself is relational, it is dynamic, it is engaged. The biggest piece, perhaps, or the biggest job of sati is to clean up the field of perception, or to clean up the field of sanya. Now, as you could probably notice, our perceptions are very rarely innocent, are they? When we perceive something, that perception plugs very, very quickly into our whole history of how we have seen this before. If we come back to the person who took the last Ruibash tea bag, we only need to see that person again, catch sight of them, and the first thing that comes into the mind is, they took the last tea bag. Perception is carrying all of our history of associations, memories, preferences, likes and dislikes that gets hooked on to what we perceive through our eyes, you know, through our ears, through our bodies. So what is sati doing? The job of mindfulness is to sever the link between perception and underlying tendency. Okay? To sever the link between perception and underlying tendency. How we perceive something as pleasant and the underlying tendency of wanting to keep it, wanting to make it last, wanting more of it. So quickly gloms onto it. We perceive something as being unpleasant, and the whole underlying tendencies of aversion, resistance, dislike, and fear seem to arise almost simultaneously. So by slowing down the process, seeing the perception and the underlying tendency arising, part of the job of sati is to sever that link. Now, it's not to suppress perception. I mean, you can see, you know, a lot of our perceptions in this life are simply practical and useful. You know, it's because of perception that I know to ring this bell rather than to drink my tea out of it, right? I know what the bell is for, you know. I know to sit on this chair rather than imagining that I can sit on the tape recorder. Eh? It's quite neutral, it's quite practical. But so many of our perceptions are not in that realm. So often perception is triggering the underlying tendency. And the job of sati is to sever that link, because that is what allows us to see anew. And that's what allows us to respond anew. I catch sight of that person, and I don't see the person, you know, necessarily who took the last tea bag. I see the whole person. I see the whole person. I hear the car alarm. I don't have the underlying tendency arising that says, you know, the world is actually here to oppress me. It's a car alarm. It's to sever the link. I mean, I hope you can appreciate that this is an enormous job of sati, because this changes our world. This changes our world. It's what allows us to see anew, and when we can see anew, we can respond to what is, can't we? When perception is clouded with underlying tendencies or linking automatically into underlying tendencies, don't we just find ourselves repeating the same reaction over and over and over again? Huh? As if there is no possibility of another way of meeting another person or the world or ourselves. So for me, this is like the biggest job of sati. The last of the jobs of sati, I would say, is to remove the sense of bewilderment from our lives. You know, have you ever found yourself coming out of the tail end of some huge psychological or emotional storm, and it's like you've woken up from a dream and you say, how did that happen? How did I end up there? How did I get there? Often followed by the word again. And this sense of mystery, you know. So what sati is doing, it's actually showing us it's not an accident. You know, it's not an accident. By slowing the process down, illuminating the process, seeing things as they are, what is enabled is your capacity really to trace this constructing of the world moment to moment. It's no mystery. And the more that we're able to trace that, clearly more options are available to us. When it all just feels like an accident, you know, when it all just feels bewildering, it's very disabling. It's very disabling in responsiveness or engagement. So that's kind of, that's the job of sati. We are clear on that, yes.
I just have one confusion that it could be just using different words, but I'm trying to understand. So when you say perception, are you sort of also meaning feeling? I'm looking at kind of, you know, feeling that goes to grasping, that goes to becoming.
Perception triggers. You know, feeling and perception are often arising pretty much simultaneously.
So there's contact.
They're not the same. Contact, feeling, perception are pretty, feeling and perception, I mean, in contact. You know, in contact, the meeting of the sense door with the sense object. Perception is pretty much arising simultaneously with feeling there.
Contact, feeling, and perception all sort of...
Yeah. The Buddha describes them as very much as being interwoven.
Okay. Hmm?
Well, clear. Yeah.
With sati, you were saying perception... is separate from the feeling that arises.
Well, they're very much interwoven. I mean, if you look at our perceptions, you know, that the feeling tone of them is pretty immediate. I mean, there are certainly some Buddhist teachers who will say that you can separate perception and feeling tone. But this is like some incredibly refined level of sati. if you look in your experience, you know, the feeling and the perception seem to be of one piece, so to speak. And the feeling is not a problem, you know. There is that in the world, some, which is unpleasant or pleasant or neutral. That's not the problem. The problem is where the feeling tone in the perception is triggering the underlying tendency.
And so sati makes you become aware, you're aware of that. The way I do it is like sort of like a noting. But I don't see that disappears or that...
We may be coming into investigation of the dhammas. Because the sati, the knowing, the slowing down, the severing, actually, you know, maybe it makes more difference than you're actually appreciating. You know, because when I don't know the difference between the unpleasant and aversion, I'm pretty impulsive and reactive. You know, if I know the difference between, you know, because if I don't know the difference between unpleasant and aversion, I am so quickly into flight or abandonment mode, you know, pushing away. But if I actually know there is a difference between unpleasant and aversion, I can pause and I can stay there. So I'm not actually being propelled by the underlying tendency. Perhaps it's arising, but it's not governing. That's a huge difference. Yeah. Yeah.
And you were just mentioning that, I realized that sometimes maybe I too quickly can, you know, that co-arising, that moment that the acknowledgement is there, that there are two things happening, it's very easy to neglect that and go immediately if my tendency is to be somewhat aversive. And so it's just in that moment when that is happening where if I can stay there, then and nothing needs to happen except staying there.
Yeah. Because by staying there, you're cultivating non-identification, you're cultivating freedom from clinging, you're free from being governed. You are actually starving the underlying tendency.
It's a very intense experience.
Yeah.
It can be.
It can be. Although if you're developing the other friends of sati, it's less intense.
And I think that's it for me. If I notice that my tendency is to get, you know, to bring intensity to that rather than to
yes.
see that they're all friends.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Are we done with sati for the moment? For the moment.
Actually, I do have a question.
Okay.
So you've slowed things down and you've made this sort of break between your perception and then your reaction. And then what? You've gotten to that quiet place, you're just holding it, you know, I'm not, you know, I've just found out, I just broke my leg. I'm just going to be with that.
Because then we're moving into the other factors of awakening and the way that mindfulness is engaging with the other factors. Okay? Sometimes it's quite sufficient just to know, actually, this is unpleasant, this is aversion, I just stay with it. Sometimes that's quite sufficient, but it's only one. You know, that would be too one-dimensional to think that that is the kind of be-all and end-all of the path. I mean, it's important to acknowledge that sati is in this sense, sati is being a guardian, a protector of the mind, of the heart. Because in starving the underlying tendencies, you know, in staying with what is, sati is actually protecting the mind from going into all those fields of proliferation, of embroidery, of reactivity, of, you know, of resistance. It's actually protecting the mind. It's starving the akusala, or the unwholesome. It's kind of it's the two dart metaphor, right? It's like the Buddha, says, like if a person is shot by a dart, you know, it will be painful for a Buddha or for a non-Buddha, right? But he says, you know, a worldly being, and being shot by the dart, will beat their breast, will wail and bemoan, and therefore they're suffering two levels of pain: the pain of the dart, and the emotional pain of this should not be happening. Huh? We're getting down to the one dart theory here. But it's also protecting the mind from the hindrances, of course. Sati is protecting the mind from the hindrances. So let's talk a little about Dhamma Vichaya, or the investigation of the Dhammas. Now, being aware that investigation is something that is occurring on the foundation of sati. If the foundation of sati is not there, sometimes investigation of the Dhammas is simply speculation or thinking. So, now, it might be heretical to some to hear that mindfulness is not enough. You will not read anywhere in the discourses that mindfulness is enough for liberation. It is the enabling factor, but it is not the be-all and end-all. You know, certainly in the discourses, mindfulness is not the end of the path, or an end in itself, that mindfulness is a vehicle for insight. We could watch forever without being watched, without what is being watched changing. Watching my broken leg forever is not going to heal my broken leg. First, we have to know the territory of that ailment. We have to know the landscape of the wound, you know, the landscape of the difficulty. But then we actually perhaps also need to proceed to the response or treatment stage if we're interested in being healed. The Buddha described investigation as the most powerful and most essential of all of the factors of awakening. And mindfulness, when well established, provides the ground for what is called the investigation of the Dhammas. And the Dhammas in this sense is just another word for the investigation of our life. The investigation of the way things actually are. It is remembering in the Satipatthana Sutta the foundations of mindfulness, or where mindfulness is established in the body, feelings, mind, everything that arises. This is the classroom of our life, because this is where suffering is born. And this is where suffering comes to an end. And if you remember the historical context of the Buddha's journey, you know, where he was raised and grew up and lived in a kind of spiritual and cultural climate where the ethos was very much one of transcendence, you know, how to get out of. You know, where body, feeling, mind, relationship, essentially all of life was regarded to be something of a problem, an obstacle to awakening. And therefore the spiritual ethos of that time was how to overcome, how to go beyond, how to get past, you know, how to transcend, and all of the kind of activities that spiritual seekers in those times engaged in, the ascetic practices, the austerity practices, the mortification practices, to subdue body and mind. when we hear about those and read about those, it's easy for us to think that this was some sort of historical error. In my experience, you know, there is a timelessness to aversion. And there is a kind of timelessness to that ethos. There are plenty of people in our culture and perhaps ourselves who are well practiced in the ways of transcending or trying to transcend our lives. You know, in our various escapism routes, in our various mortification routes, in our various austerity and fantasy routes, I actually think we're engaging in pretty similar practices. We may not be lying on beds of nails, but, you know, we're just a little more sophisticated. So certainly in the Buddhist teaching, what did he do after, you know, feeling somewhat frustrated with his years of mortification practices? He returned, of course, to the very places that he had fled from: his body, feelings, mind, and life. And understood, actually, that this is where suffering begins, this is where suffering ends. This is where freedom begins, this is where liberation is realized. It is really why the Buddha was so radical in his time, because treating this as the ground of awakening. Now, investigation very much has sati within it. It's not just thinking. But there are many, many, I think there's a number of different dimensions to investigation. And part of it is remembering what we're doing here, remembering what we value, remembering what we're cultivating, really investigating what is actually going on in our mind and heart. Now, it does take, there is a reflective element in investigation, and I'll talk about this in a bit. Mindfulness, sati, is to know the nature of our experience. Investigation is to see into the nature of our experience, or to understand the nature of our experience. It's to understand how our world is formed, what suffering is and how it ends, what leads to suffering, what leads to the end of suffering. Investigation, we might say, is the wisdom factor of sati. It's the insight factor of sati. Now, there are several different aspects, as I mentioned, to investigation. Now, one is experiential investigation. You know, and in my understanding, all of formal meditation practice is experiential investigation. You know? If I sit and a painful sensation arises in my knee, and rather than immediately flinching and running, I have the intention to actually explore the landscape of that and to see what happens when I stay with it a little to understand it. It's experiential investigation. You know? If I sit and I see a sort of judgmental thought arises, and rather than jumping right into it, I might recollect and remember and gather my attention and come back to the body rather than feeding that judgmental thought. It's experiential investigation. If I sit with sloth and torpor, and rather than just kind of falling asleep, I get really interested in what is the landscape of sloth and torpor, you know? What does it feel like? What does aversion feel like? What does craving feel like? You know, what is the taste of fear and dread? That's experiential investigation. It's not so much thinking about it, it's bringing your attention directly into experience to know and understand the landscape of it. To understand the landscape of it. So it's going beyond the familiar realm of reactivity. You know, if you're in a walking meditation and suddenly the thought arises, you know, like this is really boring, and I'm going for a cup of tea, and you renew the intention to stay with the walking rather than just falling into that familiar pattern, it's experiential investigation. You're seeing what happens when I don't. What happens if I don't? What really actually happens in me if I don't? If I don't just walk on that familiar pathway or in that familiar rut, let's see what unfolds. So there's nothing particularly sort of macho about it. You know, there's nothing particularly, you know, forcing about it. It is more of a sense of curiosity. It's more of a sense of curiosity to kind of expand the kind of territory of what we know or we think that we know. What is possible or what we think is possible. There's a level of experiential investigation which has another side to it. Now, suppose in your formal practice you bring the intention to really cultivate and nurture a very deep inner stillness. What does that tell us about the potential of our minds? You know, are we really looking at that? If we, in our formal practice, really bring about the intention to cultivate kindness or compassion, what does this tell us about the potential of our relationship with all things? So experiential investigation is not just about what we don't do. It's about the potential of what we cultivate. And to really have a taste of that, we start to really see experientially in our own constructs what it is that leads to distress and what leads to the end of distress. Seeing how our minds and lives change when there is a ground of serenity and mindfulness. We investigate, and this is very experiential, what clinging feels like. What that feels like, what's that landscape? What does it feel like in the body? What does it feel like in the mind? How does it change our perceptions? And we also investigate, what does non-clinging feel like? We shouldn't imagine that any of us walks around all day clinging. There are probably countless moments of non-clinging. Do we notice them? Do we notice what they feel like? Do we notice how our sense of the world changes in those moments? Do we notice like the contractedness, the narrowing in clinging? Do we notice when there's non-clinging and there's that sense of opening and spaciousness and ease? Do you know what selfing feels like? You investigated that. When there's a big sense of selfing, you know, I am, I need, you know, I must have. Have you investigated what that actually feels like in the body and in the mind? Have you investigated what non-selfing feels like? There are plenty of moments in the day. Again, this is not a chronic condition. You know, it is something that arises and passes. Have we actually noticed what non-selfing feels like? Have you explored that landscape? Have you really touched into it? Have you investigated the felt sense of generosity and the felt sense of withholding? You know, there is a lot going on moment to moment. You know, there's really a lot going on moment to moment. Some of it very kusala, some of it very unhelpful. Are we really paying attention? Are we really investigating? Because experiential investigation is all about being intimate with our body, mind, heart. It's seeing through the lens of mindfulness. But it is actually, this is what makes the path our own. You know? not just some technique or some theory or some abstract concept, but seeing this for ourselves. Any questions about that part of experiential investigation? Yeah.
So, realizing that I just didn't name it that. I didn't call it that. So, if I have an experience of non-clinging, I just called it an experience of surprise openness. But not recognizing that I actually should then say to myself, "Oh, this is an experience. This feeling of openness is an experience of non-clinging," and just let it be that.
It's good. I think it's very useful to mark those moments. And I think particularly because we are so prone to be problem-centered and only notice what is wrong, that we actually really are not so well trained in paying attention to what is well. You know, and it's really important to see how experiential investigation is actually going to inform your response. You know, because if I know, really know, this is what clinging feels like, or this is what selfing feels like, well, that's actually going to inform my response to that. You know, and more it's going to become a kind of cellular knowing. Huh? It becomes a sort of cellular remembering. You know how often it can happen, you know, almost so subconsciously almost, you know, kind of clinging or selfing, and, you know, suddenly your body's tight, you've got tunnel vision, you know, it's all you're seeing, you know, your mind is in this state of turmoil, you know. And actually, we start to know that landscape, and the earlier we start to see that process, because it is a process, the easier it is to respond. But it's also, I mean, if you even kind of look at a practice like deep concentration practice, you know, where people develop the jhanas, they build up a cellular memory of knowing what the body and mind feels like when it's deeply concentrated, what the body and mind feel like when there's joy, what the body and mind feel like when there's calmness, you know, what the body and mind feel like when there's collectedness. And, you know, I sometimes wonder, you know, because this is very different than trying to be on top of our experience all the time, you know, and trying to pin it down, because sometimes we're just not quite sure what is going on, and that's fine, you know. We stay with the sense of we're not quite sure what's going on. But something is going on. But the more we stay with the sense of we're not quite sure what is going on, the more likely it is that we will come to know what's going on. But there is something about kind of actually bringing that sense of curiosity into body-mind process. And the thing that we have to acknowledge is there is always body-mind process going on, including in this moment. Something is going on. We're calming or we're contracting, you know, we're enlivened or we're sleeping, you know. Do we know it? Do we know that sense of what is actually going on in this moment? So it's not about being on top of it, but it is encouraging clear comprehension. It's encouraging the clear comprehension element. And if we don't know exactly what's going on, it's not about then trying to figure it out. It's just about paying attention to not knowing what's going on. But something's gone on right now. You know, we don't live in these suspended moments interrupted by bursts of intensity that sort of startle us into wakefulness. There is always something going on here. So there's another piece here. And that is to link your direct experience of what is going on with the teaching of liberation. This is both reflective and experiential. Now, linking what is going on with the teaching of liberation is actually where we're talking about sort of an intelligent mindfulness. I use that word. I don't know what an unintelligent mindfulness looks like, but cultivating an intelligent mind, what's going on? So it's actually more, even more of a step into the kind of universal nature of experience. When I see what is going on in my body and mind, am I actually aware in the background of that, of my understanding of the unarguable nature of impermanence? You know, when I see the mental states, the thoughts, the reactions, the images, the memories, and I'm actually really, really investigating that in my practice, am I looking at that through the lens of the understanding of impermanence? How does that alter your relationship to what's going on? And and this is such an important piece, and this is what the Buddha is talking about, investigations, talking about bringing the teaching into what you see. It's not as if we just contemplate impermanence somewhere else. You know? This is where we do it. I mean, if you see in your experience selfing happening or aversion happening or clinging happening, can you see that in the light of change? What does that do? What does that do? I mean, what are the implications of that kind of investigation to quite directly investigate the changing nature of experience? What does it do? I mean, the Buddha, for example, described the understanding of impermanence as the most transforming of all insights. Why? Yeah, it certainly means that there is some encouragement around letting go here, some encouragement around cultivating non-clinging. You know, understanding that does make a little bit of a mockery of grasping, or trying to make life stand still for us in order to kind of console our fears. It actually makes us more afraid. We actually become less afraid when we don't try to make life stand still for us. I mean, impermanence is meant to be a liberating teaching, not just a good idea. And weakens craving and aversion. Very much weakens it. I mean, it kind of makes a mockery of craving and aversion. Mm-hmm. Pursuit and avoidance. And we start to see, you know, what is dukkha? What is dukkha? What is, you know, this word dukkha? And we can see that dukkha is not the world. Dukkha is is what happens when we set ourselves against the way the world is. Mm-hmm. Dukkha is in our relationship to the world, of things, of experience, of people, of images, of thoughts. So part of informing investigation with the teaching is actually contemplating through insight. Contemplating instead of through the lens of self, it's contemplating through the lens of insight. So in that landscape of my body and mind, I might actually really begin to notice, you know, that everything is in a state of flux. I might actually begin to notice how when I try to kind of freeze frame the moment through clinging, I am actually making the world of conditions somewhat the gatekeeper of my happiness. Investigating impermanence is an antidote to enchantment. You know, this kind of projection into things and peoples and objects, this implicit power to make me happy or to make me sad. It's the withdrawal of projection. It is also investigating non-self. You know, when the Buddha talks about investigation, he talks about it in the context of anicca, dukkha, and anatta. It is investigating the nature of selfing and the nature of non-self. Do we all here? You with this? And everybody has, of course, a completely clear understanding of anatta. No, that really is a serious question. Huh?
No?
It is a serious question. Yes. Yes, I mean, yes, but this is true, isn't it? I mean, this is what I was talking about, the steps of insight. It's first to have the intellectual understanding of non-self and then begin to investigate that directly in one's own experience. So it turns into, you know, an experiential understanding of non-self. That is a process, but it's a process, I think, that requires quite a bit of intentionality.
Or at the moment.
At the moment?
Understanding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I always think it is so important not to make an anatta complicated. Not to make non-self complicated, because, you know, so often it's kind of reserved to this feeling like this is like, you know, the most elusive teaching, you know, and I'll work on anicca first, you know, and then maybe in some other lifetime I'll get to anatta. This is a central teaching of the Buddha. It's probably one of the most central teachings of the Buddha. And he doesn't make it complicated. He does not make it complicated. He makes it so, you know, in fact, you know, according to the Buddha, anatta is staring us in the face every minute of our day, and we just don't like to see it. If there was a self, all I can say, it's really not doing a very good job. You know, if there really was a pilot in the cockpit, a director of operations, someone in control, they are really not doing a very good job. Because if that was so, I would only have the thoughts I want to have. I would only have the feelings I want to have. I would only have the sensations I want to have. I would only have the experiences I want to have. Not my experience of life. Really not doing a very good job. But also the just the illusory nature of it. You know? And really, really, and this is absolutely the wrong environment to say it in, but the Buddha did not teach no self. Some of you will get the subtext. The Buddha taught non-self, and these are entirely different territories. They are entirely different territories. In fact, once the Buddha said, you know, if you were going to make a choice to teach that there's an eternal self or that there's no self, he said you would be better off teaching that there's an eternal self. Because teaching no self is just nihilism.
It's just what?
It's just nihilism, nihilism. It's all it is. So he taught non-self. And I think one of the best ways of understanding that is actually to also begin to notice the many moments of non-selfing in the day. When you're not creating a center, when you're not creating a kind of director of operations, when there's not this sense of othering, you know, and objectifying. They are there. They are there. And all the Buddha was teaching in anatta is that nothing has, there's no thing that has any independent self-existence. Mm-hmm. That there's no thing that has any independent self-existence. This is what the Buddha was teaching in non-self, you know. And actually in the Buddha's time, you know, the Buddha often encouraged people to start with that, to investigate that externally rather than internally, because he appreciated the sort of resistance to seeing it internally. So he started in encouraging people to contemplate that externally, that when we see the chair, certainly there is the appearance of a chair, there's the form of a chair, but when we really, really look at the chair, we all would acknowledge this chair has no independent self-existence that is not independent of conditions. You know, for this chair to exist, that someone had to have the thought about a chair, someone had to figure out how to make plastic and steel. You know, this all began in the elements of the earth somewhere, and at some point that we can't even see, it will turn into another matrix of conditions that will go on. And it is, in a sense, beginningless and endless. And when the Buddha was teaching about non-self, he was not actually saying that you should negate yourself, you know, or try to annihilate you, but to see that I have no independent self-existence. I am not independent of conditions. You know, this particular matrix of conditions that I call me has a history that goes long before I can ever know or could know. And it will have a future long before I can ever know or will know. And it is simply this matrix of conditions in this moment that has an appearance and a name and a form. It's all. There's nothing complicated here. it's evident, you know? And we cannot find anything in the world that is outside of that interwoven condition, contingency of conditions. There is nothing outside of it. And then into that we plant this curious idea that somehow I am independent of conditions, that I have a self-existence. And that's why I say, if that is so, I'm really not doing a very good job. I'm really not being very effective. I mean, there is something incredibly liberating and kind about giving up this idea of being the center of operations. It doesn't mean we're helpless. It doesn't mean that we don't make wise choices. It doesn't mean that we sacrifice discernment. But what we do give up is a whole lot of suffering. We give up a whole lot of suffering. And that's what the teaching of non-self was all about. It's actually about giving up suffering. Okay, so this might be a good... Oh, by the way, in remembering what I said this morning, that Pali being a language of verbs, I would really encourage you to turn self into a verb. Selfing. The selfing of the moment. Selfing of the moment. It's actually a much more accessible way to work with this than to think of this noun that's somehow hiding there. Okay, so I think that is a good time for us to take some time for some walking. I'm sure you're ready for a bit of movement.